Welcome to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. My mother, Caroline, is not with us today, but check in next week and she will be back on the air. We have a really fun book today. I know I've said that before, but this was just so much fun to read. A House Full of Windsor by Kristen Contino. I hope I'm saying her name correctly.
You are.
All right. So A House Full of Windsor is Kristen's much-anticipated follow-up to the 2050s, The Legacy of Us. And when she's not writing fiction, Kristen serves as chief reporter at Royal Central, where she covers royal news from around the world and tries not to buy too many of the Duchess of Cambridge's outfits. And, of course, this is... we'll get a little bit more into what A House Full of Windsor is all about. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Kristen.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
All right. So A House Full of Windsor, obviously some connection to the royal family. What is this book?
So the book is about Debbie and her daughter, Sarah, and we follow Debbie from the 1980s through the present day and her history of loving the royal family and being a royal family collector to the point where she has become a compulsive hoarder. And we see how her royal collection destroys her marriage, which there are also other factors there, but you know, for the most part, it's a huge reason in the destruction of her marriage and, you know, relationships within her family and how her family comes together to, you know, go on this reality show to confront not only, you know, the mess that's physically there, but their collective mess and emotional drama from the past. And, you know, I think I'm making it sound serious now, but it's... As you know, it is a lighthearted book, but also touches on some serious issues, too.
So, obviously, you are a royal fan yourself. How did that start?
I've always been, you know, interested in the royal family, and my mother was super big into Princess Diana when I was growing up, and I became, you know, interested a lot in the history and culture of Britain when I was studying abroad in college in London. So I eventually, you know, when William and Kate got married, became more interested myself in following them, you know, more avidly, I guess you would say. And I've always been a writer, you know, ever since I was very, very young and ended up, you know, creating my own royalty fashion blog and eventually started writing for Royal Central.
Now, what is Royal Central?
So Royal Central is the world's number one online source for royal family news, and that's around the world, so not just the British royal family. So we cover, you know, Asia, Europe, every monarchy there is, and I mostly focus on the British royal family, but, you know, I do sometimes dip into the European royal families too, which is a lot of fun.
Is this kind of your dream job, writing about the royals?
I guess so. I mean, it's not something I ever thought about. And this isn't my full-time job, just for that to be clear. This is a freelance. I do have a day job that's rather boring and we won't talk about.
Is it writing related too?
I do online editing. It's not really related to journalism at all. But I really enjoy it. And it's a fun departure from your everyday life. When, you know, you get to cover exciting events and weddings and things like that. And it's definitely something I enjoy doing.
Now, Debbie, the main character, one of the main characters, Debbie and Sarah, her daughter, are kind of the two main characters in A House Full of Windsor. So Debbie was in college in London in what year would that have been? The 80s?
So it is. Yeah, it's in the early 80s, so she's there at the time when Diana and Charles are getting married.
Okay.
In 1981.
Okay. And so are her experiences as a student there based on your own?
No. Yes and no, I guess. Yes, in the sense that I wanted to explore the idea of what if you never left? Because I know a lot of my friends, when we were there, we had this sense of devastation when we were leaving because we all became so close and we loved the city, we loved our school. And there was a real sense of loss when you had to leave and come back to your normal life. So in that sense, I played upon the, well, what if you didn't have to leave idea, although it doesn't really go well for Debbie. But Debbie actually does go to the college where I studied abroad in London. So that was my little shout out there.
And have you returned to London much since then?
Oh yeah, I go back every year, at least once, although with the pandemic, obviously not for a while, but yeah, so yeah, I go back often and, I have a lot of friends in the UK. Actually, my day job, is with a UK site. So my coworkers work in the UK who I've become friends with. And yeah, I have actually, a decent amount of friends I've made through social media channels and becoming involved in, royal circles that live there. So I always have people to visit, which is great.
Yeah. You know, that idea of what if you never left, when I was, the last time I was in Europe, which I've gone a number of times, but the last time I was in Italy, because my nephew was studying in Rome to be a priest, mm-hmm. and he actually was serving on the altar with Pope Francis for his New Year's Day Mass in New Year's Day 2018. So my sister and I went to see her son with the Pope, and
that's
then
really cool.
Isn't that cool? And then we were traveling a little bit in the area, and we went up to Florence, which I had been to Florence in 2003, I think, and so this was now 15 years later. And I went into a little shop along the Arno River, and the owner was an American woman who had, or not actually, she wasn't the owner, but the woman working there was an American mm-hmm. woman about my age who had gone to Italy in the 70s as a college student, met and fell in love and stayed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
She's kind of a Debbie.
That's yeah,
funny.
She's kind of a Debbie. And it was this great little paper shop where they made like handmade stationery and hand-printed leather goods. I have this beautiful little mini billfold that was from there, and just beautiful things. So she...
Yeah, I love Florence. The Legacy of Us, my first book, is actually set partially in Florence. I love it. It's so beautiful there.
Yeah. So The Legacy of Us was your first novel, and that came out in 2015? Is that
mm-hmm.
correct? Okay. So
yeah.
Was this the first novel that you wrote or the first novel that you published?
So that was the first novel I wrote.
Okay.
And
published.
I started, yes, and published, and... I started working on it in, I don't even really know. I was in my early 20s and I just kind of did it when I felt like it as a hobby. And I mean, I guess in a way, it's not really the first novel I wrote in the sense that when I first started writing it, the characters are the same, but it had a different title and it didn't have this multi-generational point of view. I was just having it with the modern characters, and they were just out of college and trying to figure out what to do with their lives, and I just wasn't really sure where to go with it, I guess, and I was not taking it seriously at all. I mean, it was sometimes I would go a year without touching it, and I was trying to think of, kind of an idea for a novel, and I thought, oh, well, I can use this. I'm just going to add different points of view. And then I had the storyline of, there being a family heirloom that's passed down through the generations and how it connects them all. And so these modern characters that I was writing, they ended up being in the book, but it was just a different perspective. So I started really seriously working on it in 2010 because I had lost my job at the time and I had nothing else to do. I mean, to be perfectly honest, yeah, I I had a lot of time on my hands. So I finished it in 2011, I want to say. And then, you know, you go through the editing and I found critique partners. I joined RWA, you know, all of those things.
Now, what's RWA? You know,
Romance Writers of America.
Okay.
So I joined my local chapter and, you know, met people where I was able to take workshops and learn about craft and, you know, actually make this book into something that was sellable. And then, you know, all the querying, and by the time, you know, I got a contract and it came out, it was 2015. But it was a good, you know, over 10 years, probably.
In the making. Yeah. So in terms of being able to find a publisher, then, was like belonging to Romance Writers of America, was that a big help for you?
I mean, not necessarily in that sense, only because I was writing book reviews at the time for a site that doesn't exist anymore called examiner.com. And so I had a book review column and I was getting tons of books, you know, sent to me by all the publishers all the time. And so I made a lot of contacts, you know, in the industry, publicists and things like that. And that's how I ended up getting connected, because I had a contact and mentioned that I was writing my own book. And, you know, that's how it worked out. But I mean, I definitely think that it's great for people to be involved in, you know, I'm in Women's Fiction Writers Association now, which is a wonderful organization. And just groups like that are really helpful, just to be able to have access to workshops and networking and all of that stuff. And I think a lot of people I know have been able to find, you know, an agent or a publisher through some sort of event or a connection they've made through them. So I think that's great.
Absolutely. Have you been a member of like local writers groups too? The critique groups?
No. Yeah. I'm just a member of my RWA chapter. And I know there are, you know, some local groups like that too, but I find it's helpful to be with people who are writing the same type of things you are, just because sometimes it can be all over the place. Some people are writing nonfiction or thrillers or whatever. And, you know, when you're having access to, you know, events that are focused on your type of writing, I personally find that more beneficial. But I mean, I'm sure there are other people who really love like getting a mix too.
Yeah, I think both ways have value, but particularly as the recipient of critique, it can be, if somebody is critiquing you that doesn't read the type of work that you're writing,
mm-hmm.
they may try and steer you in a wrong direction for sure.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. I one time had, I had a writer's group I was a part of for many, many years, and we've sort of lost touch in maybe the last 5 years or so, but probably over 20, 25 years, we would meet sporadically. And the core group was great. But then one time we were, you know, we had included another person and on my, basically when they read what I had written, their critique was basically, you should write a different story. This, you shouldn't write this story. They didn't like the story because, to be honest, was very much from a female and feminist perspective. And
okay, yeah.
And they didn't like the story. And it's like, I'm sorry, but that is not an appropriate critique to give.
No. Yeah, I think that's, you know, in part, like you said, it's just being surrounded by people who know the genre and know, you know, what is expected is really important, you know, for me to receive feedback.
Yeah. Obviously, we didn't invite that person back again. But, you know, you have to be careful who you show things to when you're in the development stage of something.
Yeah. Yes, so, I agree.
Okay, so A House Full of Windsor. What you talked about, you know, wanting to explore the idea of what if you never came back, or, you know, didn't have to leave. But of course, that's not where the story ends up. So
no.
Did you know that when you started writing, or did that come about later?
So I guess to go back to the beginning, I got the idea for the book because I was watching an episode of Hoarders, and this woman was talking about her mother being a hoarder and how she grew up in this home and how it had impacted her life. And it was really interesting to me because she was talking about, like, as an adult, how she looked at relationships, her career, all these different things, and how she interacted with her friends and stuff were all rooted in her growing up in this house. And so I thought that was a really interesting idea to explore in fiction. And I wanted it to be a mother-daughter story. I knew that off the bat. And bringing, I honestly don't remember when I decided, to bring the royal aspect in, but I knew I didn't want to write, like a heavy, depressing, dead animals in the house hoarding type of book. And, I wanted to look at the psychological aspects of why, but also do it in an accessible way. So I think her having this very thematic collection and making that kind of more palatable helped. But yes, I knew, always that they were going to look back at how she got there and then bring us to the present of, how they're trying to fix the problem.
And of course, her hoarding not only impacted her marriage, but really did have an impact on all of her children. And she's kind of in denial about that, kind of realizes it. What other, like, how did you actually research the psychology of hoarding?
So I got a few really great nonfiction books, and one of them, ironically, is called Stuff, which I had already the show, and for those listening, the show in the book is called Stuff. It's basically Hoarders. And I had already called it that myself, so I thought this is a great sign. This is the book I have to read. And I was researching things as I was going along, and yeah, I thought that was a good sign. But anyway, it's a very interesting book, and it's written by some psychiatrists who are in the hoarding field, and just talks about their years of research and dealing with people and kind of the reasons why people hoard. I thought that was just fascinating on a personal level, even if I wasn't writing the book. And I also read a memoir of a woman whose mother was a hoarder, just, getting into that perspective of the child. And I have a friend whose mother is a hoarder, so I spoke to her, a lot about what it was like and that sort of thing. I had never been in her, her childhood home or anything like that, but she was helpful just to answer some questions as I was going along, which was great, to have that kind of firsthand perspective.
Absolutely. Where is the line between a normal messy person and a hoarder? Or even not all hoarders are messy. Some of them are very organized, but
Yeah, like
yeah.
Deb, like Debbie in the book, she has everything labeled. They're all in bins. Oh, she's not
And how
really
common is
messy.
that? And I'm also curious how common that is among hoarders.
Yeah, I think that, it can be kind of a fine line between us, but I think when you can't see that you're buying so many things and the house is filling up. I mean, there's a difference between, oh, I just leave my stuff laying around too. I can't walk through the house. So I think, I don't know how common it is, honestly, to be, this organized, but it's, hoarding is all over the spectrum. And there are definitely people who, like Debbie, she has all her things in bins. They're not thrown all over the place. She has them labeled. But then, you see people where it's just mountains of things. You can't walk through the house. And, to go back to saying, where do you draw the line? I think the kind of the line is if you can't move through your home, safely, there's things piled up everywhere and you're not using them. Because there's a difference between being messy, where, like, I mean, I can be a bit messy myself, where I might leave magazines on the sofa. I'm using them. I know where they are and I know that I have them, but if I had so many magazines that, I didn't look at them ever, and they were just collecting dust. And,
and you,
you know,
couldn't
I didn't
sit on the
know.
Sofa because they
yeah,
were all
I couldn't
over the
sit
sofa.
On the sofa. You know, that's, I think that's a big difference.
Not, and not all hoarders actually are shopaholics either. I would say a minor version of hoarding kind of runs in my family. I don't have it, but my grandmother certainly did, and other members who I won't mention, but had this tendency to hang on to a lot of stuff. But they don't buy stuff. It just gets passed down. It's a lot of family stuff.
Totally. Yes, I have a family member who does that with receipts, and I found receipts from like when I was a child, like pay stubs, like a shoebox of pay stubs from, you know, the 80s. And I was like, why do you still have these? You don't need these. Let's shred them.
When we were cleaning out my grandmother's house, and this would have been in the 90s, there was drawers full of utility bills from the 50s. Mixed in with, you know, maybe a magazine, mixed in with an actual historical document. For example, we found deeds to properties from the 1800s and letters from Civil War soldiers and things. So it was all, of those things were kind of in one place. There was a basket that had a lot of the letters, but these old bills were mixed in with things you had to actually go through and sort through because there were things of value mixed in with it. When I was cleaning, I did sort through things, but one of my brothers helped a lot, and I don't think that he did sort as much. I think he just threw.
I've had several people tell me after reading the book, well, I went and cleaned out my garage or something like that. And I was like, well, I mean, that wasn't really my intended consequence, but that's good.
Well, I'm curious, like, I haven't ever watched Hoarders. I think it hits maybe a little too close to home. Not that I grew up in a hoarding house, a household that would qualify, but more clutter than I'm comfortable with sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I did have a friend years ago whom I've lost touch with who was a little bit across the border of being a hoarder. And how do they ever, I mean, how can they actually change? Is it possible?
I think, I mean, it's definitely possible, but it requires, you know, therapy and follow-up and dedication to that, because there are certainly people who do, you know, get help and get an organizer and, you know, are receiving therapy. But sometimes a lot of it is triggered from some sort of incident. And a lot of times you see, oh, well, after my husband died, I couldn't let go of any of his things, and, you know, all the belongings are still there, or that type of thing. Or I turned to collecting after in Debbie's case, turned to collecting because she had a bad marriage. And it's these kind of traumas have to be addressed too, I think, in order for people to overcome it fully. Because if you're using, you know, shopping or, you know, not giving things away because they're connected to this personal trauma, then, you know, if you can't overcome that, you can't get rid of the stuff. And that's part of what we see in the book too, because Debbie has to overcome all of this stuff from her past, and the reasons why she's holding on to a lot of it are, you know, tied to specific memories of her marriage and her time in the UK. And when she kind of learns to forgive and let go is when she finally, you know, not to have a spoiler, but and, you know, help move on.
Now, why do people actually agree to go on a reality show about that? I would think it would be so traumatic to not only be able to let go of the stuff that, you know, has this huge trauma associated with it, but also to have it public like that.
I think you really need to want, you know, the help, and you don't know where else to get it. And that's, you know, kind of a guarantee that someone's going to come and clean out your house. But I think in a lot of scenarios like Debbie, you're probably kind of strong-armed into it by family members, because you see a lot of people on these shows who they are adamant, like, they don't want to get rid of this stuff. But a lot of times they're kind of forced into it, either, I think, by ultimatums or, you know, the county is going to take my house away if I don't, you know, do X, Y, Z type situations. So I don't always think that it's necessarily their first top idea, but it's a way to get help.
Yeah. Without having to pay for it yourself.
Yeah. Cause I mean, thinking of hiring, you know, a private organizer or these cleaning crews, I mean, the cost of that would be significant.
Yes, for sure. And is there more than one reality show like this, or is Hoarders it?
There's two that I know. There's Hoarders, and then there's another one that's called Hoarding Buried Alive. I think that's the title. That's basically the same show.
And do they provide psychological counseling to the people on the
they
show?
They do,
too?
Yeah. They provide, you know, follow-up and that sort of stuff. I'm not sure for how long. But, you know, in my version of, you know, the show stuff, that they're, you know, continuing the follow-up. And, you know, when we're leaving the book on a hopeful note, but you also wonder, you know, is Debbie going to keep up what she's learned? Because I didn't want it to be, you know, unrealistic to the point where, you know, I think she mentions that it's, you know, like little cartoon birds are flying around in this like perfect reveal. But, you know, in her head, she's still kind of, okay, am I going to be able to keep this up? Like, it looks bare in here. Like, it's not that instant fix that, okay, you know, now you're not a hoarder anymore.
No, I imagine you would kind of, there'd be a strong tendency to start it all over again. Yeah. And it's easy to do, to just, oh, you know, look at this cute little thing.
Yeah. And I think it's easy, you know, if you're someone who's a collector. I mean, I like to collect things, but, you know, once you get to a certain, I mean, I've even said, well, do I really need another, you know, teacup or whatever. Even if it's something you like, you think at a certain point you run out of room, and that's, I mean, also, like we were talking about, the difference between collecting and hoarding, I suppose, is, you know, if you're a hoarder, you're not going to have that moment of, well, do I need this?
Right.
Do I have room for it?
Right.
Yeah. I want it. I'm getting it. You know,
yeah.
I'll deal with it later.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Kristen Contino, author of A House Full of Windsor. Kristen, why don't you read a little bit from the book for us?
Sure. Sarah says, primp before you prep. A thorough cleaning of your home is important before company comes, but don't forget to take time for yourself. You should be dressed and party ready before you fluff the pillows, light the candles, and hang those colorful hand towels. What's worse, your guests walking in on you pushing a Hoover, or having no one there to answer the door because you're still showering? Dirty secrets are best swept under the rug. And when it comes to my family, I'm akin to a professional housekeeper. Just hand me a broom and I'll brush away anything unseemly, leaving a perfectly normal and color-coordinated scene behind. The problem is dirt builds up under that rug. Eventually, it starts to show. From the exterior, I'm sure my mother's house looked like a typical colonial in her tree-lined suburban Philadelphia neighborhood. But I knew better, and it was time to actually do something about it. So I gestured to the tidy fraud of a house as Will and I got out of our sister's SUV. Can you promise not to freak out this time? My brother let out a small huff. When have I ever freaked out about anything? I raised an eyebrow. The last time you and Anne showed up, Mom had to pop a Xanax. And if I recall, so did you. Way ahead of you there. Want one? Or is there a Sarah Says tip against self-medicating? I shook my head and turned to look for Anne. She leaned against the driver's side of her Audi Q7, no minivan for this soccer mom, texting with gritted teeth, probably something to do with the kids, not like she'd tell me anyway. Twin, you in or you out, Will said, and finally Anne dropped the phone to her oversized leather tote. Fine, let's get this over with. Leaves crunched under my hunter wellies as we headed toward the side door, and soon enough, Anne's riding boots clacked against the driveway, drowning the sound out. Will trudged along a step behind in his signature Chuck Taylor's, ever the Brooklyn hipster. Should we knock? He tapped me on the shoulder as I stared at the rusted old storm door. The awkwardness of this question was not lost on me. It was our mother's house, for God's sake, but the situation wasn't exactly normal. I shrugged. Anne, do you know if the side door is still blocked? How would I know? I haven't been inside since the last time the two of you decided to make an appearance. She might as well have said, since you guys moved to New York and left me. I swallowed the guilt trip and rang the doorbell, giving the belt of my red pea coat a quick tug as if tightening it would somehow prepare me for the battle ahead. We waited outside for a good 3 or 4 minutes, chatting about the weather and Anne's kids, and my anxiety heightened with every passing second. I knew it could easily be another 5 minutes before Mom reached the door, and how would she react when we broke the news about the cleanup? We were there under the pretense of a belated Thanksgiving lunch, but I knew she probably saw through our intentions. Should we try again or go to the front? Will popped down on the little wood bench in the carport, and soon his thumbs were flying across the keyboard of his iPad. 14 emails since we got off the train. If I wasn't leaving this job soon, I might just sprawl out in the middle of Times Square and wait for the tourists to trample me to death. God, don't be so dramatic, Anne said, not looking up from her cell. And wait, what's going on with your job? Her voice dipped just slightly, enough for me to register her annoyance. I guess twin intuition didn't extend across the Hudson. That's part of why I suggested we come here. I mean, other than the Thanksgiving thing, he gritted his teeth and wrinkled his nose in a sorry for bringing it up type of face. Unfortunately, the news doesn't stop for the holidays. I kept my tone light, but inside my stomach twisted. If I'd put an ounce of focus on something other than my career, I'd probably be married with one or two curly-headed munchkins instead of spending Saturday nights alphabetizing my bookshelves and Googling dumpster rentals for my mother. Anne finally looked up from her phone. It's okay to put your career first sometimes, but you can't be such a robot. I mean, we've all got baggage because of this. She rolled a slender finger around in a circle, gesturing to the house. It's called compromise. You could have taken the train down after your show. You know what? I hardly think. I closed my eyes for a second. My sister, of all people, should understand what Mom's baggage had cost me. Boyfriends, the friends I'd kept at arm's length, a parade of therapists. But arguing with Anne was just as pointless as trying to convince my niece Ruby that her little brother's name wasn't Charlie Poop Pants. Why bother? Instead, I told them I was going to call Mom before we got into Will's job news. I whipped out the same forced, cheerful tone I used with my Good Morning New York audience. Mom, we've been waiting outside for a while now, so I just wanted to make sure you heard. Patience, my dear. Do you expect me to run to the bloody door? Of course not. Just wanted to make sure everything's all right. I could sense her irritation before the words even came out. You know I've got that pesky arthritis. I'm not as young as I used to be. Give me a minute, or would you rather just bin the whole idea and I'll just meet you at lunch? Spare us all the trouble of... Well, you know. No, don't worry, I said, trying to rescue the day before her mood turned sour. I'll see you soon. I sighed and slumped down on the bench next to Will, resting my head on his shoulder. How did we end up in this situation? I could hear a bit of Essex slip back into my accent, as it sometimes did around my family. Despite 20-plus years of living in America, thousands of dollars in elocution lessons, and the countless How to Sound Posh YouTube videos I'd watched, and pronunciation books I'd read since we moved to the States. It must have been the stress. This is partially my fault, Will said. I should come more often. I had no idea how bad she'd let it get. He tapped his foot so fast that Anne, ever so gently, stomped on it with her boot. You know I hate it when you do that. It reminds me of, Will shot her a look, point taken. You'd think the two of them were married, but maybe sharing the same uterus for 9 months counted as much. I glanced over at the little Union Jack sign still hanging next to the door after all of these years. It said the Windsors in red letters above the flag, and decades later, it still riled me up that Mom somehow thought it was fine to conveniently ignore the fact that her children had a different last name. I guess the Windsors and Percys didn't have the same ring to it. Don't get me started on the sign, Will said, noticing me staring. Anne rolled her eyes, and the three of us said at once, no relation to the royals, but you never know. Okay, new topic, I said. What's going on with this job? Just as Will was about to respond, the door creaked open. Hello, darlings, Mom said with an ear-to-ear grin. I hadn't seen her that happy since her favorite online shop, Cheerio, at a 75% off sale. Her wild gray curls had been tamed down more than usual, and she was wearing a crystal poppy brooch on her sweater, her secret good luck charm. Come on in then, but watch your step. I took a deep breath, counting backward from 5 as I let it out. It obviously meant a lot to Mom that we were willing to come inside, so I knew I had to push back the feelings of shame and disgust I connected with my teenage home. But like most things having to do with my mother, it was easier said than done. At least the mess couldn't have gotten too much worse since I'd visited in September, or so I hoped. The way Anne's mouth dropped as she stepped into the kitchen told me everything. That, and the choice expletives she muttered under her breath. Welcome to the House of Windsor, my dears. Mind your step. I was glad Mom's back was turned as she said this so she couldn't see our expressions, which ranged from shocked, mine, to disgusted, Anne's, to slightly bewildered mixed with morbid curiosity, Will's. The strawberry wallpaper stuck in the 1990s kitchen, although cluttered, had never been the problem. The mess started with the dining room where boxes, plastic storage bags, and bins hadn't been emptied of their purchases, covered every conceivable surface. The disaster grew progressively worse throughout the rest of the house, or at least it had the last time I stepped inside. Despite Mom telling me she had done a big cleanup, I was still stepping over boxes of Golden Jubilee china and Hello magazines and plastic sleeves. I figured it was business as usual. I thought you said she straightened up, Will whispered. Then I lost my footing and crashed into his back. She did. Will reached for my hand as we attempted to squeeze through the narrow passageway leading to the living room, and I turned to grab Anne's behind me. Plastic storage bins stacked at least 5 high flanked us on both sides, and I gasped as a large container marked Diana Fashions 1985 wobbled precariously when my shoulder hit it. I'd been to the ER enough times in my life thanks to Mom's collecting, but having to explain a cast or bruise to my colleagues would feel 1,000 times worse than another sprain or concussion.
All right, that's a good place to stop because we gotta just a little bit of an idea of what it's really like inside this house, and of course all the interactions and the impact it has on everybody. But I gotta say, as I was reading, you know, I really did have a lot of sympathy for Debbie, and that was because of the way that you went back and forth between the present and the past, and mm-hmm. you know, how this developed. Was that always? Did you always know you were going to do that?
I guess so, but I am definitely a pantser in terms of writing, where I didn't outline this book at all. I just kind of went with it, and I knew, you know, the general idea of what was going to happen. But yeah, I guess, yeah, I don't really know that I knew I was always going to do that, but that's just how it happened.
And so a lot of that has to do, you know, her history has to do with the connection she felt with Princess Di, because she was in England during the royal wedding. Mm-hmm. She met her husband, the kid's father, right around that time. She got married not too long after. She and Princess Di were pregnant at the same time. So, and you said mm-hmm. your mother was a fan of Princess Di. Did you, what do you think, you know, why do you think she had such an impact on people?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, around my age, or, you know, a little younger, a little older, had that same, you know, growing up with Diana, or mothers growing up with Diana, or they loved her and looked up to her as, you know, this icon. And I think maybe a lot of it was, like you said, with Debbie, feeling a kinship that, you know, you were going through similar things at the same time, or maybe she was the same age as your mother, or, you know, that type of thing, and feeling that you can relate. I think people, you know, now can feel that same way about Will and Kate, where I can see where, you know, they're about my same age, and we've had kids around the same time. You know, my son is the same age as George. You feel like you're going through the same things as they are, and it's like a relatable figure to you, even if you don't know them. So I think there's a little bit of that. But I also think, you know, seeing her have, you know, all of this charity work and the impact she made on people, and people loved that, and how, you know, down to earth she was, and, kindness and reaching out to help people who, are not as fortunate as you. That's something that I think she in particular, touched people in that way and made people love her. And I wanted Debbie to just have that feeling of this connection where, like you said, they were getting married or having kids or whatever at the same time, but also they were both marrying into a family where they felt like outsiders a bit, like they weren't quite accepted, where it was a difficult relationship. So she felt this kinship to her in that sense. And I wanted to, especially make sure to tie in that, like, she was finding out she was pregnant when she was, and all of those things, their separation was the same time as their marriage was down the tubes. So she could continue to kind of attach herself to her and, want to keep buying all these books and magazines and buying things about her and copying her style and all of this stuff to kind of create this storm around Debbie.
Now you talked about, sort of feeling some kinship with William and Kate yourself. What about Harry and Meghan?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, they're the around my age too. And I think it's so fascinating seeing the differences, between the brothers and how this is playing out. And, of course, professionally, it's always something going on and something to write about. And, it's never boring. That is for sure.
Now in A House Full of Windsor, you drop a hint about some rumor that Prince Charles isn't Harry's real father.
That's been going on for years.
And do you think there's any validity to it?
No, I don't think so. But Diana admittedly had an affair, and the man, he has reddish hair, and you can't deny, a mild resemblance in that sense. But I don't, I think Harry looks quite a lot like his grandfather in many pictures you can see when they're young. I mean, there's definitely that Windsor in him, and I don't, believe for a second that's not his father, but it's certainly a rumor that's gone on, and, people sometimes like to carry that.
Yeah. I've never been, really fascinated by the royals. I just figure they're people like everybody else. And what do you see as the future for the royal family? Do you think that they'll continue the way they are, or has it come to the point where things do have to change?
I think that change definitely is happening and has to happen. And we're seeing as the years progress, Princess Margaret, which wasn't, it was not that long ago when you think about it, that she wasn't allowed to marry the man she was in love with because, he just wasn't deemed suitable. He was divorced, and she had to give up and sacrifice that, continue to be part of the royal family. And then, fast forward to today, Harry and Meghan got married. She's divorced. They got married. Everybody celebrated it. Of course, the outcome wasn't necessarily great for them, and they decided to move to the U.S. But the marriage happened, and, not that long ago, that wouldn't have even been a possibility. So I think, there is change, but I think modernizing certainly needs to happen. And the charity work they do is incredible, and these initiatives they're carrying out, and they do a lot of good in the world. But for that to continue, I think William and Kate especially have this on their hands, because Charles is in his 70s, so we don't know how long he would be on the throne. I think a lot of it is on them to help modernize things and become more relatable to the public, which they're doing a great job of right now.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Kristen Contino with her second novel, A House Full of Windsor. So we talked a little bit about the writing process for your first book, But was it similar for A House Full of Windsor, or did you do things differently this time around?
I mean, it was certainly faster, but I had already written a book at this point, and, you know, I was serious about getting it done in a timely fashion and getting it published. But I mean, it also, in that sense, took five years at least, actually probably a little more. And that was mostly because of the market and rejections and me taking a break from writing for 2 years. And I think it felt different in the sense that I had finished it, you know, much more quickly. I knew what I was doing. I was proud of the book, and things had happened in a faster way in that sense, where I signed on with an agent. You know, I was being shopped around, and I was like, okay, this is it. This is where I'm going. And it was totally not. I mean, nothing worked out. And that was, I think, a lesson in perseverance for me that felt, you know, almost, you know, more rewarding than having my first book out, because I, you know, encountered a lot of obstacles, and it was turned down, you know, if you add in agents and publishers, probably 100 times at least.
Wow. I'm really surprised. So,
oh, well, thank you.
Yeah. Well, first of all, because it's such a delightful book to read, and it's a fairly, you know, there's a certain number of people who would read it just because of the connection with the royals, with, you know,
yeah,
that like reading about that. And you had already successfully been published. So what was the main obstacle, do you think?
So I think at the time when I was shopping the book, which was 2016, a lot of the feedback, you know, we were getting from publishers was, this isn't right for the market right now. I'm not seeing other books like this. You know, and then there's always, you know, the things which are totally subjective, like, I love Debbie and not Sarah. I love Sarah and not Debbie. What would the next person be? And you were like, really? But it was more of a continuous, this isn't right for the market. And markets change. So I think that was an important lesson for me, in the sense that, okay, like, maybe this book isn't right for now, but it could be. And I saw a pretty big shift, you know, in the subsequent years to like a lighter, you know, rom-com books, where it became suddenly super popular again. We were seeing like these illustrated covers and more lighthearted fiction were selling well, where, you know, the chick lit kind of had its heyday. And I wouldn't necessarily say this is chick lit, because it has a lot more serious topics, but, you know, those types of books kind of took a back seat for a while. And I think especially in the pandemic, a lot of people were like, I don't want to read a depressing, you know, this guy killed his wife book. And a lot of this domestic thrillers are still popular in those type of books, but for a while it was like all that was selling was, you know, these domestic suspense and girl on the train type stuff and World War II fiction, and
yeah,
you know, it was harder to get a more, you know, kind of lighthearted book in there. And honestly, I also think what worked in my favor was, from, you know, comparing 2015 to today, the royals are even more, everything with Harry and Meghan happening, the royals constantly in the news, the crown, all of that stuff. I think that helped a lot, to be honest, in terms of being able to market this. So that was, you know, another thing that happened in my favor, but it's really just timing. I think that's what it comes down to with a lot of books, is you could have this great book that you think people will love, but if it's not the timing in the market or what people are buying or what people think people are buying, it's also another story.
yeah.
You know, it might not work. And not to say that people wouldn't have enjoyed this book 5 years ago. I think they would have, but it's kind of harder to sell that when you're not seeing a lot of that, you know, out there.
I know. And it's interesting because, like you said, the market's changed. So if you write based on what the market is today, by the time you're finished and it's ready to be out there, the market might be completely different. And so what do you do?
I know,
You
and
really
it's
kind of
like,
got to write what you love, don't you?
yes, I think it's just a lesson to, write what you love, and, maybe if it's not the right time, you can hold on to it and, do something with it later. But I also think it's part of, establishing yourself and, just having one book out that, maybe didn't get a ton of attention isn't going to necessarily ensure that your next book is going to get a contract. And it's just, I feel like it's a lot of the luck of the draw at the end of the day.
I interviewed a writer, it was a local writer some years ago, who had a very, what would you say? He'd had his first book had been published to great critical acclaim and not great sales. And it made it much, much harder for him to get published the second time around.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot where,
Yeah.
if you have this book and people are really counting it, that it's going to be a bestseller and then it's not, it's almost worse than if you've never been published.
Yeah. Because we do, I think a lot of writers think, well, once you get one book published, then you obviously will get, the next one will be easy. So it's really kind of good to talk to somebody who that wasn't the case, so that it's not just you if it happens.
Yeah, definitely not. And I know so many people. I mean, I can think of two or three friends who had books come out that same summer as me in 2015, who haven't had a second book come out yet. And, they haven't been successful in doing that yet, for various reasons. So, it's definitely not a guarantee, which, now I sound depressing, but.
Yeah. Oh. So what's your next book?
So I'm working on another book right now, which actually just before you called me, had an email from one of my critique partners who had read the first 10 chapters. So I need to take a look at her suggestions on that. But my next book is it focuses a little bit more on romantic relationships versus Houseful of Windsor is definitely a family relationship book, and there is, two romantic subplots in there, but there's not a lot of focus on that because it's really, about the character's journey in terms of, herself. I mean, there's some romance, but this book is definitely more focused on a romance, and it does take place in the UK. Yeah, I don't want to say too much about it yet because it's not done, but I'm
Is
excited to, finish it.
it contemporary, or are you going back in time again like you did on your other two
It's
books?
contemporary. So
Okay,
this is
yeah.
the first book I've written that is entirely contemporary, which is a new experience for me.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you're writing a book that's contemporary only, how to make it timeless is a challenge, I
Yeah,
think.
I
Yeah.
think so. And I've always written from multiple points of view. So this book is actually the first book I've written that also has a male point of view. It's not just from a female point of view. So that has been fun for me.
Oh, interesting. So do you have a trusted male confidant that you bounce things off of to say, is this, what do you think? Would a guy actually think this way?
I mean, my husband's pretty good for that kind of stuff, but I haven't shown the, I mean, like I mentioned, my critique partner who just emailed me, that was, the first time that I had shown it to really anyone because it hasn't been easy to finish this book since I did take a break from writing for a couple of years. So it's kind of been in limbo, and I'm just now getting back into this groove where I'm coming out of I'm still obviously marketing A Houseful of Windsor because it just came out in July, but I'm also kind of coming up for air too, where I can get back into working on something new.
So what is your writing schedule look like? Do you write a certain time a day, or do you just like whenever you can fit it in?
Yeah, I don't have a schedule. It is whenever I can fit it in. And that's mostly because, you know, I work full time. I also freelance, and I have, you know, a young son, and
and so you have nothing else to do.
Yeah, so, you know, when I have nothing else to do, I work on fiction writing. No, but yeah, it's really when I have time, and that's something that I struggle with personally in being, you know, when I'm not under contract, because this book I have, you know, I'm working on right now isn't under a contract. So it's good and bad because I don't have anything lighting a fire under me necessarily to finish this in any given amount of time. Mm. And I really have to, you know, work on making sure that I'm hitting, you know, word count goals per week or something like that to keep myself on track, because okay, otherwise it's very easy, I think, especially if you're a person who is just like, okay, well, I'll do it tomorrow, you know, okay, well, okay, that didn't work out, or it's very easy to fall into that trap of it'll get done later.
Yeah,
without next, you know,
and probably really, you want to build on the momentum from A House Full of Windsor, which I think are you getting fairly good attention for this book?
Yeah, it's actually been great so far. I mean, getting, you know, great reviews. I mean, it was really well reviewed in Kirkus and Forward, which are, you know, two great publications, and getting some press attention, which has been wonderful. So, like you said, I'm definitely keen to kind of keep that momentum going. So I don't want to stretch this out too long, you know, between books, like that, you know, I had a 5-year gap between my first and second, and you know, I definitely
don't want to do that again. Yeah. Well, Kristen, we're about out of time, and I just want to thank you for joining us. Just like I mentioned, I really enjoyed reading the book, and you know, kind of identified with both the characters, both Debbie and Sarah, in different ways. But I liked both of them. So whoever the people who said they liked one and not the other, they didn't know what they were talking about.
Thank you.
And, you know, usually when Caroline's with us, she finds a quote to close her show. So I found one that I think is apropos. And this is from David Wong, who is a writer, and he says, "So why do we call her crazy for piling her trailer full of more cats than she could take care of, but applaud when somebody accumulates more money than they can spend? They're both hoarders."
Oh, wow. That's an interesting
concept. Interesting concept. So thank you once again for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.